Good evening. Welcome to Shadow Politics, a grassroots talk show, which is on a mission to make America think again. We're not going to tell you how to feel or who to vote for. We're just going to put the information out there because a vote is a terrible thing to waste. And we have troubles in America these days, folks, and we all need to be intelligent voters. So we're going to bring the experts forth that know what's going on, and because it's in the shadows, really, that the decisions are made that make the world go round. So we're trying to bring them to light. And tonight we have two very special guests. We have with us people from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. We have the D.C. campaign manager, Claire Mills. D.C. is very close to my heart, you know. And we also have Quentin Scott, who's the federal director for policy, I believe. And welcome to the show, guys, and thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Let me start before I start with Claire and ask her what's going on in D.C., let me just tell you my opinion of the environment these days, and you tell me how far off I am. But I think this is really the critical issue for the 21st century, global climate change. And I think we're in really bad shape. We've just seen this horrendous storm in Jamaica. And I understand that three of the five worst storms on record have happened since 2020. So is global climate change the menace that I think it is? That's for you, Quentin.
Sorry about that. Global climate change is the menace that you think it is. As you mentioned, we have seen record storms in the last handful of years. And then the last 3 years, we've seen the three hottest years on recorded record. So we have escalating warming globally. We see intensifying storms. Just last year, we saw Hurricane Helene. We also saw a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico that in less than 24 hours went from just a tropical storm to a Category 5. So we are in a dire situation, and we don't have leadership that is focused on addressing the climate crisis right now. And so that is why CCAN is really working hard to make sure that we keep it front of mind and holding our leaders accountable to addressing the crisis of our generation.
Well, you know, I remember taking an environmental course back in the Stone Age when I was in college. And I remember my professor saying that this would be a consequence. Now, this is 40 years ago, folks. I remember my science professor saying that this would be the consequence of increased global warming, increased climate change, more storms, bigger storms. And that's the thing that really gets me about all this is that I look and I see everything he said 40 years ago is happening. And I don't know why people don't get it. Let me ask this to Claire. I see that we have Liberty with us. Liberty, your mic's not on. You should put your mic.
Hi,
there
everyone.
We go.
Hi,
right, thanks for being there. But let me ask you, Claire. DC prides itself on being a green city. Are we doing enough in the District of Columbia?
Yeah, I think DC does pride itself on being an environmentally focused city, and we have made a lot of progress over the last 15 years. DC has some of the most ambitious climate commitments to net zero and to building standards. And so there's been a lot of good work done to build up our Department of Energy and Environment and to set standards for where we want to get to by 2030, 2045. But unfortunately, I think we've seen some lack of ambition from the Bowser administration in the last couple of years, from our city council in the last couple of years to do what it takes to reach those commitments. in the past couple of budgets, Mayor Bowser has proposed stalling or getting rid of some of our environmental commitments like net zero, like building energy performance standards. There's always a struggle to get programs funded. And so while we do have really ambitious commitments and goals, it's been a whole second battle of getting all of our areas of government moving in the right direction to actually reach those goals.
Yeah, it very much surprises me that we've elected, with all the stuff that's going on in the environment, I don't know how you could ignore what's going on, but that we've got a guy out there who got elected by saying "drill, baby, drill." It's just crazy. Liberty, do you have something brilliant to add? This is my
Yeah.
co-host, Liberty Jones. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I'm having a little technical issues. I hope you can hear me all right. Thanks so
Yeah,
much
we
for
hear you.
being on today. I have a question for you, and it's kind of a creative question, let's say. I had the experience of going to the Chesapeake Bay a couple months ago, and I saw that out in the water they actually had a mining site. And I'm not sure if it was like Exelon or fossil fuels or what was going on there, but do you guys do a lot with that? Has CCAN fought pipelines and fracking and all these projects? What do you think is the next major fight for that in the Chesapeake region right now, especially with Trump opening up the space for that as well?
Yeah, just to give a little context to our organization, Chesapeake is certainly in our name, but we don't deal directly a lot with the Chesapeake Bay. Chesapeake in our name is just to sort of represent the region. But CCAN does have a long history of fighting pipelines. For example, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that was defeated at the very beginning of the Biden administration. We've also been very active in fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline that is running from West Virginia through Virginia to the North Carolina coast. And we've certainly had some setbacks in that fight. But yeah. CCAN was founded on the idea of fighting pipelines and reducing our carbon emissions in our region. To your point about Trump, Trump has been extremely hostile towards clean energy and climate initiatives, to say the least. I mean, we're talking about he's canceled grants for like Solar for All. That was a committed program from the EPA to bring clean solar energy to low and middle income communities. We've seen him cancel programs at the EPA dedicated to tracking methane emissions in communities, which were really key for environmental justice communities to actually understand how much methane was in their communities. Of course, this past summer, the Trump administration passed the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. Of course, we call it the Big Ugly Bill, which canceled tens of billions of dollars in clean energy tax credits that were really deploying the cleanest forms of energy and making them overly competitive with the fossil fuel industry. But that's largely why they canceled those tax credits, because the fossil fuel industry doesn't want competition. And so they eliminated those tax credits and made sure that they continue to have those subsidies. And so that is one of the fights that CCAN has been on the forefront of.
Well, and
Yeah,
let me
and
ask. I'm sorry, go ahead, Claire.
yeah, I was just going to build off of what Quentin said to give the DC and like local example too. So Quentin mentioned a lot of these pipelines that are transmitting gas from where it's generated to cities. And then once it gets there, it enters into the distribution system. So the pipes that are just getting it to your house. And those systems in a lot of cities across the East Coast are getting really old and very leaky. Here in DC, we have a huge gas leak problem, and the utility has this program called Project Pipes, which in theory is supposed to address gas leaks, but in reality is just them randomly essentially replacing pipes across the city. There isn't like a clear metric they're using to select those pipes. And it's at the end of the day, a way for the utilities to make a ton of money. Off of customers, we pay for it in a surcharge. It then gets added into sort of the like infrastructure we pay for on all of our bills. And so CCAN has a lot of experience at that sort of large level of pipeline, all the way down to the pipelines in our cities, trying to get the whole country off of methane gas. And just want to shout out the Solar for All program that Quentin mentioned at the federal level. The federal program is modeled off of one that started here in DC by the same name. So we have a local Solar for All program that was so effective, it got brought up to the federal level and recreated for the whole country. And that's one example of some of the leadership that DC has had in the past on climate, and the kind of thing that, we could do again, but we also see defunding of our local Solar for All, just like the federal program right now.
Well, you bring up money, Claire, and this is another thing that astounds me. Gas prices aren't really going down. They go down, they go up, they go down, they go up. Electricity prices are going up very quickly. So none of this stuff that Trump seems to want to do to feed the fossil fuel industry is helping consumers, and that's what it was supposed to be about, right? It was supposed to be about American dominance in energy and how it was going to bring down prices. Let me ask you, how I understand that AI is at the bottom of a lot of the electricity increases for homeowners because they use so much energy. Do you think that's going to put a strain on the energy system in America? Is that going to be our next environmental a challenge to figure out how to use AI without destroying the grid? Either one of you, how do you feel about that?
I could take that. Thank you for raising AI and by extension data centers. So we actually have a campaign at CCAN that's sort of ramping up to address sort of the data center challenge. But in actuality, it's actually a conversion of multiple campaigns sort of coming together. The last handful of years, there has been efforts to do permitting reform so we can build out more transmission for clean energy, but it's run into a lot of roadblocks because the two parties actually can't agree on some common principles. But because of data centers, it's actually sort of created this momentum in recent weeks to pass a permanent reform bill so they can build out more data centers and build out more transmission to support data centers. However, there are a lot of concerns around data centers related to land usage, water usage. As you mentioned already, it is adding to our electric bills because just here in the PJM region, which is the grid operator for the DMV area, we're talking about in the next 5 years, we're going to see a demand increase of 32 gigawatts of energy. Now, that's equivalent to about 24 million homes. And 30 gigawatts of that is just data centers alone because of AI and cryptocurrency. And so, what we have been really pressing on our state leaders and our federal leaders and our grid operator, PJM, is that they have to have a plan to actually address this huge energy demand and boom because of data centers. Because they have to build out an estimated $163 billion worth of infrastructure just to accommodate it. And right now, as it currently stands, when they pass those costs onto ratepayers, we're talking about each of our bills are going to go up by about $70 per month. And so, to avoid that huge ratepayer increase, one thing that we've been demanding of our leaders is that they implement the idea of bring your own energy. So if they want to connect their massive data centers to the grid, then they need to bring their own energy, but just not any energy. They have to be it has to be clean and reliable and affordable energy, like wind, solar, and battery storage. And so that's what we've really been working with. And we actually have a letter that we've been circulating the last few weeks. And this week we're going to actually do a press conference tomorrow and a press release on Wednesday, where we're demanding PJM and demanding of our state and federal leaders that they make sure that these data centers don't become the problem for ratepayers, especially when some of these companies like Microsoft and Meta and Amazon are worth trillions of dollars and they should be paying for these infrastructure costs, not ratepayers like us.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Claire, am I wrong? We're getting a lot of these. Isn't there one of these big data centers going in Virginia right now?
Yeah, the entire region of sort of Northern Virginia and increasingly across the state is one of the main hubs in the country for these big data centers. And as Quentin was saying, because we're on a regional grid, PJM, that means that what gets added on in Virginia or, all the way up to New Jersey and across a lot of the East Coast, things that get added onto the grid, like a big data center in Virginia, has an impact on electricity prices in DC and places all around the country.
I got to pay for energy for people in New Jersey. I moved from New Jersey to get away from those people. I don't want to pay for them. Liberty, what do you got to say?
So that's very troubling to me. I feel like we're going through a different rate, form of the Industrial Revolution right now. I saw an article that I think the electric company Dominion was talking about how this new data center and the growth of these centers is really going to threaten reliability on the grid as well. Do you agree with that? And I have another question for you. If that is so, a very big problem that we do see sometimes with these centers is that they're sited near disadvantaged communities. Is that a part of your appeal that noise, water, and air quality concerns will maybe be brought up to attention in the new reform? How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, reliability is an absolute concern because of these data centers. The expansion of the building of data centers is at a much greater rate than what we're deploying to the grid. So we're very quickly running up on the limits of what the grid can actually withstand. And so it actually has created a secondary problem that, a lot of states in recent years had passed laws to retire coal plants to protect our environment. And what has happened is the federal government has forced these states to keep some of these most dangerous and most pollutant coal plants ever built open because we have to address this energy crunch from data centers. And to your point, Liberty, a lot of these data centers and coal plants are located near communities that are disadvantaged politically. And so that's why they are siting those projects in those locations, which is precisely why organizations like CCAN and others are, partnering with these community members and speaking out and pushing back on the siting of these projects. And we've seen in small cases where individual communities have actually achieved victories against some of these data centers, or at least delayed them from being built. So we are very like new into some of these fights this year, but it's certainly the big fight of probably the next decade.
Well, let me ask you something about CCAN. How is your membership? Is your membership growing? Do you see people more interested in these issues than were interested in these issues, let's say, 4 years ago? Is there more interest out there? Because I wonder what's happened to the climate movement. I was a consultant for many years, and one of the first things I worked on was an anniversary celebration for Earth Day, which I think started in the 1970s. And it seemed to me there was a real active community. It may have been just that I was involved, but is the community still active? Are these things, the horrible storms and the other things we see happening, are they generating more interest in the climate movement, and are more people joining? What's your experience there at CCAN?
I think that there absolutely are a lot of people getting activated right now around these issues. I mean, take for example, in the recent elections in Virginia, these issues we were just talking about, data centers, the price of electricity and high utility bills were some of the biggest issues in the election. Like these are things that are really ac actively impacting people and families all across the country. So I think broadly speaking, folks might think about it as if they're interested in these high utility bills or these big storms and extreme weather that they're seeing, and want to do something about those things. Like in DC, our sort of two main campaigns that we're working on right now, one is that pro campaign against Project Pipes I mentioned, which is directly about utility bills. And then our other campaign is about making polluters pay for climate damages, which is directly about how we're going to respond to this extreme weather. And we see like really incredible growth in our volunteer engagement and how much people are taking on leadership roles and becoming experts in complicated things like utility regulation. So I think the climate movement looks different than it might have looked at 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But I still think there's a very active movement that's really based in addressing people's material needs, the everyday needs of folks, and the way that climate change intersects with that in people's lives.
Building on what
I can
Claire,
go ahead.
building on build, yes, building on what Claire just said, I do think that our members are, our member base is expanding, as well as our members are sort of meeting the sort of political moment. Just a few months ago, we saw President Trump at the UN, completely call climate change a hoax, and he, said to countries that, if you're investing in clean energy, you're going to regret it. Your countries are going to be go to crap and those kind of things. And, even Doge very early on removed climate science from federal web pages. And, they had this idea of like burying their heads in the sand as if all of a sudden climate change will go away. And our members have really responded to that by really showing up in really big ways. When we ask them to show up for protests and rallies, we get hundreds of people to show up at the at NOAA right here in Silver Spring. But in addition to that, anytime we have asked our members to participate in sort of EPA comment periods, just to step back, the administration has been very directly trying to repeal a lot of climate rules and environmental rules to make it easier for fossil fuel companies to drill and transport fossil fuel products. And so we've been asking our members to participate in the public comment periods. Now, the comments themselves might not stop the Trump administration from repealing some of these rules, but it's really important for two reasons that we submit comments. One, it builds a robust public record that courts and lawyers can use if these repeals ever go to the courts and litigate it. And then the second thing that it does, it builds a really robust record for the next administration to know this is what the public wants. And so the moment that they come into office, they know exactly what policies to put back in place. And what we've seen is nearly 8,000 of our members actually submitted a comment when the administration started to repeal the endangerment finding. And the endangerment finding is the sort of legal connection between what we're observing in our natural world and US climate policy. And I would say that was probably our most comments that our membership had ever submitted was this year with that 8,000. When we've done comment periods in the past, we might get 4,000 or 5,000 comments. And the fact that we got nearly 8,000 this year really shows to me that our members are paying attention, they're engaged, and they're, they're following through on the actions that we're asking them to do.
Okay, so tell us, since we've asked you on the show just for this reason, to get the word out about this stuff, because it's crazy that the Trump administration has removed all references to climate change as if it's not happening. But tell people how they can get in touch with you. What's your website? How maybe we can get 10,000 comments next time. So tell us how tell our listeners how do we get a how do we get in touch with CCAN? And
Yeah,
how do we send you money?
you could go to we have two websites. We have CCANActionFund.org, which is our C4 nonprofit where we do a lot of our sort of policy work. But you can also go to I think it's just CCAN.org, and which you can also donate and volunteer on that page as well.
Chesapeake
Okay, and
Climate.
you know what? We'll
There it is,
post.
Chesapeake
Go
Climate.
ahead. Go ahead,
It's
Claire. Did you want to say?
chesapeakeclimate.org.
Oh, and we'll post that on our website, folks. If you want to go to the BBS website, we'll post those addresses so you can find those places. And my advice as a 40-year politician is you should beat all the Democrats over the head with what happened in Virginia, because that's the way to get them to change. Say, this is something people care about, and if you want to get elected, pal, you better care about it too. I assume that Ms. San Governor-elect Sandberger was the beneficiary of good climate policy in that election. Is that right?
Yes. Before she decides to run for governor, she was a member of the House of Representatives.
Right.
And Representative Spanberger was an amazing champion on the Inflation Reduction Act. She actually was the leading voice for advocating for $20 billion in climate investments towards the agriculture community. And so a lot of the work that CCAN has done over the last 3 years in terms of agriculture and implementation of climate smart ag was because of the work Representative Governor-elect Spanberger did when she was in the House of Representatives.
Well, that's great. And we should remind the Democrats of that every step of the way, because that's really what gets politicians to move. They're the most self-interested people on the planet. So I think that would really be a great strategy. Probably a strategy you're already employing, but I just thought I would point that out. Let me ask you one more thing before I let Liberty come in and ask a better question. What's the how about the carbon trading? I know that EPA has really kind of stepped on that. Where do we stand? Wasn't there a thing where we had regulations that you had to mitigate the carbon you put into the atmosphere? Is that where do we stand on policies like that?
I'm not sure exactly which carbon policy you're speaking towards.
Well,
There
wasn't
were.
there a carbon trading policy where you were expected to do certain things to mitigate the damage based on how much carbon you put in the atmosphere, or you were taxed based on how much carbon you put in the atmosphere? Weren't there regulations? Maybe I'm mistaken, but.
Yeah, so there was a small methane fee that the EPA just sort of implemented at, towards the end of the Biden administration. But there was a something called the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program, which required all companies to report how much carbon emissions that they emitted every year, and based on those numbers. They actually were either they had to either pay a methane fee or if they actually reduced their carbon emissions, they actually got tax incentives. And so the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program is very essential towards understanding how each company is emitting, how much greenhouse gas emissions each company is emitting, and if they're actually following through on their laws and requirements at the state and federal level. And unfortunately, the administration is in the process of trying to repeal that program. And we actually got over 2,700 of our members to submit comments on that program as well from the EPA. That's their bottom line. They're actively trying to repeal that program, and it will be a major setback towards holding companies accountable for their carbon emissions.
I do want to mention also one of the things we really advocate for at CCAM is we obviously have our federal team doing great work at the federal level. We have state teams doing work in Maryland and Virginia, here in DC. And we also do work, at the more, even more local level than that. And so just like one example around here is REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. That is sort of this carbon trading model you were talking about, Michael. And that is still happening and is still active. And we see these attacks at the federal level. One of the best things that advocates can do is make sure that our state and our regional responses that are either in place or that we could add on are as strong as possible. And there's a lot of opportunity to do that across the Chesapeake region and the country, even as, federal programs are under attack by the Trump administration.
So, Liberty, give us a young person's perspective on what's going on. What scares
So,
you?
what scares me? So many things. Through all of this, I think the majority of people still would rather, at least college students, would rather not have to read a one-page article and ask a robot to read it for them that disperses, what's the rate exactly? Like insane amounts of carbon dioxide into the air per second. People, I think the humans are selfish, and I think that they haven't realized yet that it's not the land that needs to be controlled, but it's actually us that needs to be controlled. I have more of a general question for you. I think about this a lot, and I don't really know. I think right now, obviously, is a time where we're suffering a lot of political turmoil in terms of climate action. But would you guys say that our biggest barrier to climate action, let's say in this decade, is more scientific, technological, or political?
I think that my answer is definitely political. We have a lot of amazing solutions that are ready to be rolled out right now. Even just like keeping it very basic, talking about solar panels and offshore wind, those things have incredible potential to help cut down carbon emissions across the country and shift us to cleaner, more affordable energy. And the biggest barriers to getting those things up and running are absolutely not technology. They are ready to go at any moment. It's that those projects are getting attacked by the Trump administration, or that our regional grid operator, PJM, is not prioritizing them, and we're stuck in administrative backlog. So I think the good news is that we actually have a lot of the solutions and answers, and that it's just about how do we get these things rolling and get it online and convince people that this is possible and the best path forward. And to me, that's actually really exciting because I'm not a scientist, and if it was a scientific problem, that would be a lot harder for me to do something about. But a political problem means that it's all of our problem and that we all have power to fix it and do something about it and get the folks that are in power to do something about it. So, I think it's mostly a political problem, and I actually think that's good news for us.
Yeah, I agree with
Are
Claire.
you?
It is definitely a political problem. It's not a technological problem. Actually, a few weeks ago, or I believe it was September 21st, we had something called Sunday, which was a celebration of solar energy. And essentially, we were celebrating the technological advances of clean energy over the last several decades to where both wind and solar are the cheapest forms of energy. You have the ability, a nuclear power plant worth of solar energy is deployed by China every day because they have mastered sort of the production of solar panels. We even have solar panels that we call them balcony solar in Germany, where you could just, if you live in an apartment building, you could just hang that over the side and plug it into the wall and you have solar energy. We've seen in Pakistan that they are just using TikTok videos and YouTube videos to assemble solar panels and putting it on their rooftops, and then they are like detaching themselves from the dirty grid that they have in Pakistan. So from a technological standpoint, we have all that we need to like meet the moment and meet this crisis. And the only thing holding us back is, as Claire said, is a political one. But that's also very encouraging because we can solve the political one pretty, not easily, but there are a lot of opportunities, which is exactly why so many organizations and people on Sunday, which was September 21st, all came together to talk about the technological advances of clean energy so we can keep pushing it and keep putting pressure, political pressure, on our leaders to make it even easier to deploy.
Are people in the environmental movement also trying to pressure people like organized labor? Because isn't there a lot of jobs in solar energy? Isn't there a lot of potential work if we convert more to social energy? I mean, solar energy that we have to train people to put the panels on, and they're good paying jobs from what I understand. Is that not true?
You're absolutely right, Michael. And I would say 10 years ago, sometimes labor unions were a barrier, a political barrier to pushing clean energy policies. But a lot of the unions have come around, especially the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW.
EW, yeah.
They have really gotten behind the opportunities to build out More solar energy, more transmission lines. You also have steel workers who are behind wind turbines, because steel is used to build the offshore wind turbines. And just a few weeks ago, CCAN and some other Maryland-based clean energy or clean advocates were with Senator Van Hollen and Representative Johnny O in Baltimore, where we had a press conference talking about all the jobs that would come to the Baltimore region and the Chesapeake region if we are able to build offshore wind off the coast of Maryland, which the Trump administration pulled the permits for that offshore wind project. And they're really standing in the way of deploying more and more offshore wind. And so, to your point, Michael, there are thousands of jobs directly and indirectly if we invest in the clean energy future. And the labor unions are starting to really see that and are starting to really play a part in that political conversation.
Well, I would think that they would want to. I'm a former Teamster, and we were always pushing for more work and more work and more work. And China, I understand China's made a major investment in green energy. And are they ahead of where we are in the United States?
Yes, very easily. Like I mentioned earlier, they deploy a gigawatt, which is one nuclear power plant of solar energy every day, because that is where they're investing their manufacturing sector. They are creating jobs around it, and so they are ahead, and they just continue to be ahead. And we don't. The Trump administration is standing in the way of good clean energy policies that would certainly close the gap and would, 10, 15 years from now, if the Inflation Reduction Act tax credits were still in place, would make the United States a hub for clean energy, which is certainly the energy of the future. I'm not sure exactly where this administration thinks they're going to sell all this oil and gas to, when there's a lot of evidence that indicates that Europe has already peaked, and then countries in Asia and South America, they're trending in that direction as well.
Well, and am I correct in that the more oil you pump out of the ground doesn't necessarily mean the more gasoline you get? So gas prices aren't necessarily going to reflect a drop because we're drilling more oil, because we don't have the capacity to turn it into gas, right? We have to build more refineries to be able to handle more oil, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, Claire, were you about to say something?
I was just going to say that the existing fossil fuel infrastructure is like the most expensive option when it comes to infrastructure, and building anything new along those lines, the cost you're going to have to put in for the energy that you get out, speaking in comparable terms to all of the clean energy options that Quentin just talked about, it is nowhere near affordable. So I think you're right, Michael, that these investments in any kind of investment in spending on more fossil fuel infrastructure is really just locking us into the energy sources of last century. And it's not even just what these companies put into necessarily building. It's also, as Quentin was mentioning earlier, keeping these old facilities online, not retiring coal plants, not retiring gas plants. That is incredibly expensive. And that we see directly reflected in our utility bills. The cost of the gas in your home or the electric in your home is driven up by the cost of keeping these older, more expensive fossil fuel plants online. Whereas if we put in cheaper solar energy, cheaper wind energy, that would take down the cost to sort of maintain energy systems and supply energy and would lower all of our bills. So this has a really direct impact on every single one of us that pays a utility bill.
And isn't there an interest in the energy business in solar energy? I mean, if we're all driving electric cars, I'm sure that oil companies will find a way to make a profit at it by generating electricity for the cars or so. I mean, isn't there a way to get the energy companies to convert, or are they just, it's just too difficult to get them to move because they're interested in the short-term profit?
Well, we certainly want electric vehicles to be charged with clean energy from wind and solar. So we wouldn't necessarily encourage the dirty fossil fuel companies to generate energy for those vehicles. But I personally believe it is a failure of vision from these companies. They certainly have all the resources to pivot towards cleaner energy sources and energy sources of the future. And you see some utility and energy companies doing exactly that, but not enough, not nearly enough. You see, for example, Liberty mentioned the company Dominion earlier. Dominion is very intentional about diversifying their sort of portfolio. Now, they certainly have the encouragement from the state legislature to make that happen, but they are investing. They're currently building an offshore wind facility. I think it's 180 or 161 turbines, somewhere like that,
Wow.
off the coast of Virginia Beach. And they're also, looking to invest in other clean energy across the state of Virginia. They certainly are also trying to take advantage of the resurgence of dirty energy from this Trump administration, where they proposed a 1,000 gigawatt gas plant in Virginia. But luckily, we have a lot of political infrastructure in Virginia to push back against that project, and they're having some problems citing it. But again, you have companies that are more aggressive in diversifying their portfolios than others, but they certainly had encouragement from laws wherever their state companies are based.
Liberty, you got something to say?
Yeah, I do. With these frameworks changing, do you think that what we have in place, you mentioned it before, the endangerment finding, you think that's sufficient as a legal foundation? Or do you think that it's time that maybe we need new statutory and of greenhouse gases and pollutants to avoid reinterpretation, because that's how the legality of things work. They make it out to be what they want to. Do you think maybe it would be beneficial to evolve that, or do you think it's beneficial?
No, I think we certainly need to evolve. It has been the efforts of a lot of legal minds that we've partnered with to sort of evolve the legal findings for some time now, because a lot of these earlier statutes were from the Obama early in the Obama administration, and we've learned so much more about climate change. We've evolved in the way we think about solving the climate crisis to include environmental justice. We've also included more just sort of community engagement, and so there have always been some gaps that advocates have been trying to fill around the statutes. And we were slowly, finally, under the Biden administration, making slow progress to evolve those statutes. But this Trump administration, again, is just going wholesale, get rid of all of it. And so it does give us an opportunity in a future administration to rethink how we can make stronger statutes that are more inclusive, that are more direct, that accelerate us to meet the moment. The crisis moment. And so, yes, it's frustrating to see what this administration is rolling back, but it does give me some hope that in the future we can rebuild in a much better way.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point made at the end. Obviously, over the past couple of months in DC, it has been an unprecedented, as a word, doesn't really even begin to cover what has happened. Just the attacks on DC's ability to govern ourselves, deploying of the National Guard, this ramping up from the Trump administration, focus and attacks on the district. One of the things that we talk about, folks that are doing organizing work in DC, and I'm going to borrow from one of our great partners, Free DC, that works on promoting DC statehood, is that what we see around the world and in history is that after these periods where we take a step backward, like the Trump administration, where there are authoritarian regimes or fascist regimes, or very conservative regimes. One of the potential outcomes of these, and sort of the best case scenario, which has repeatedly happened, is that it actually encourages a huge amount of progress. So if we are able to do the work now of organizing, getting folks involved, getting folks out to vote, doing the work that will take to move us from where we are now to the next administration and the future, there is actually a real possibility that that will be the moment of the most progress we have ever seen on climate and on all these other issues around the country right now. So I think it's obviously challenging to see so many attacks on like the legal foundations of climate change and just our country and democracy. But I really do hold on to that idea that we have seen in history that this can be a great opportunity for people to rally together and make changes to actually get something even better than we had before.
Well, I think you make a very important point there, Claire. For 18 years I served to try to get DC statehood, make it a reality. And one of the problems that we had, one of our major problems, was that nobody else feels our pain. This is a very local problem in a lot of ways. That's one of the things that surprises me about the environmental movement, that I feel like we should all be feeling the pain of the environment, of what's going on in places like Jamaica and North Carolina and Louisiana and all these places are having trouble. But it seems that we're more interested in a lower price of gasoline than we are about saving the future for our children. It just astounds me. So what do I ask Mayor Bowser for next time I see her, Claire?
Well, I think there's sort of two parts to that. Like I've talked about, one of the main campaigns that we work on here is about utility regulation. It's ultimately about, we have these utility regulators, the public service commissioners. There's three commissioners, and they make a lot of really impactful decisions about what our utility companies here in the district are going to invest in, what our rates will be. And Mayor Bowser appoints those commissioners. So I think if you're really interested in making a difference on the climate side here in DC, on your on lowering your utility bills, Mayor Bowser is starting to think about who she's going to appoint next in the commission. There's two commissioners who are up for reappointment next year. And both of those commissioners have had a really terrible track record on climate issues and really just the concept that they are responsible for upholding and implementing DC's climate laws as part of the laws that utilities are held accountable to. So you can ask her to appoint some better commissioners to our Public Service Commission. And then to the issue of DC autonomy, I mean, I think it's really important that we have a local government that doesn't comply in advance with the Trump administration, that stands up for DC home rule, and does the investment that the city needs in the programs that help it run. That is really like our best way, our best defense against the attacks of the Trump administration. The negative framing of DC is making the city run as best as it can, and be the example that we know DC has been before. And so, yeah, I think on the clean energy side, we need some new commissioners in our Public Service Commission, and on the autonomy side, we need a mayor that's going to stand up for DC.
Well, I got to tell you, as a kid that grew up in a bad neighborhood of North New Jersey, I can tell you that capitulating to a bully never works. And I've tried to mention this to the mayor on several occasions, but and it hasn't done her any good. I mean, they haven't been. She has capitulated several times. She scraped Black Lives Matter off the streets. They made me take down my. I had a sign up for years talking about her disenfranchised status. They made me take it down. But yeah, they're not getting anywhere by capitulating. So I agree with you 100%. Stand up to this bully. And I will tell her to appoint better commissioners, but I got to be honest with you, Claire, she doesn't much listen to me, so I wouldn't put too much stock in it. Liberty, go ahead.
So, what do you think? What do you think is our best way to move forward after Trump? So obviously we don't know what's to come, but he's throwing a lot of fireballs, I'm gonna say. What do you think? Are you guys coming up with like a plan for after he's gone, what you want to try and work around because he's very invasive, or is that, are you focusing more on the present?
So, we have to do two things at the same time. And so we are thinking about the present and making sure that we're doing all we can to preserve what we can and address people's lived experiences. But also, we are just starting to sort of lay the foundation of what potentially 2029 could look like, and what sort of climate policies and ambitions that we can have. But I think the thing that we can all sort of take away from the election to a few Tuesdays ago is the fact that what the American people want is bold leadership. And so we need ideas and a plan and a vision that doesn't just address our challenges in small ways, whether it's affordability or the climate crisis. We need big, bold ideas that meet the scale of the problem. And so I think what we'll be doing over the next few years and demanding of our political leaders in 2026 and in 2028 is that they go big. And we're not going to take no for an answer. We're not going to water down and negotiate against ourselves and do half of what we did, because there's a really good argument that under the Biden administration, we allowed Joe Manchin to water down some of our most ambitious ideas. And the Inflation Reduction Act was certainly a good step, but it was about half of all the things we ever demanded in the Build Back Better bill, which passed the House of Representatives a year earlier from the Inflation Reduction Act. And so what I see in 2029 is us dusting off some of our plans from the early parts of the Biden administration, where Bernie Sanders put forward something called the Thrive Act, which was like a $10 trillion plan to invest in affordable housing, resilient communities, address climate change, make a living wage. And those are the type of bold ideas that we're going to need to build a campaign around and make it the vision for America going forward.
Well, we're out of time here, guys. First, let me thank you for coming on, because this has been a great conversation and you've given us a lot of information. But we have a minute or two left. If you want to tell us if there's something you want to say that we haven't asked, or is there something you want to add, either one of you.
Yeah, I can add this real quickly. We've talked a lot about, future policies and things that we can do down the road. One of our campaigns that the federal team is working on currently is to help people in the moment, their lived experiences. So as we are experiencing more extreme weather events because of the climate crisis, because like hurricanes and floods, the Trump administration has been systematically dismantling FEMA, which is a federal emergency management agency that responds to federal disasters. And so we've been pushing back. He created a review council that will do the pretenses of dismantling FEMA. And so we've been really putting a lot of pressure on members of that council not to dismantle FEMA. And actually, it seems like Congress agrees with us, because in a bipartisan effort, Representative Graves from Missouri and Representative Larson from Washington put forward the FEMA Act of 2025, which we endorsed last week, actually. And we're looking forward to pushing that forward, because as we're trying to address the climate crisis in the future, we want to make sure we're taking care of people now as they're experiencing the impacts of climate change.
Well, that's
Yeah,
a
and
perfect note to end on. Go ahead, Claire. Go ahead. And
yeah, I just want to
Claire,
say,
when you're done, tell us your website again so people know how to get there. Go ahead.
yeah, absolutely. I just want to say, if people are in DC, in the DC area, we are going to be outside the Public Service Commission, that utility regulator I mentioned, this Tuesday, the 18th. We'll be there in the morning, 8:15. This is down on 325 G Street in DC. We are going to be there protesting that methane gas project that I talked about, Project Pipes. And if you're feeling a little bit inspired to take some action on getting cleaner energy and more affordable energy, this is a good opportunity to show up and be part of it. And yeah, if you want to learn more about all of the work that CCAN is doing and get more involved with us, you can talk to some of our organizers and be a part of our membership and the people that are really going to get us from where we are to where we want to be. So you can learn more about us on chesapeakeclimate.org.
Well, Quentin Scott and Claire Mills, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you for the good work you're doing to keep us still breathing clean air, I hope. And I hope you come back sometime in the future as things progress or if there's any development so we could talk again, because I think this has been a very useful discussion. And as always, Liberty Jones, thanks for making me look good. And this is. We close out with a song. We leave you with a song every week, and here's one from Marvin Gaye. And when you listen to the lyrics of this song, "Mercy, Mercy Me, the Ecology," think to yourself, he wrote this 45 years ago. So this is nothing new. This is something that's been out there for a long time, and we really need to deal with this crisis as soon as we can. Thank you for being with us, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael and Liberty.
Thanks, y'all.